Miserable as we are in this gosh darn cold, it's terrible outside. That's a Maroon 5 cover by First to 11. Thank you, Anya, always queuing it up well. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join our stack show today, 844-967-2789. We're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Civic Media's own Jimmy Kosca to talk about the State Education Conference that is ongoing right now. They're probably putting down a couple of adult beverages since the substantive portion of their day is now concluded. Can't blame them for that. What are conferences for if not to drink with your colleagues? And in the last part of our hour, we're going to be joined by Terry Barr to talk about what's local and overlooked here in Wisconsin. Big weekend of sports coming up. Civic Media is going to be carrying the Packers game. Coverage will start around 3 o'clock on Saturday. Anya's going to let us know during the break, the different places you can listen to it. I'll report that out to you. I am going to be making a personal appearance at Linneman's River West Lodge, 1000 East Locust, to crack some jokes and watch some Packers. If you want to come see me live and in the flesh, you can join me there. I'll be there semi-calling the game. I don't know enough about football to actually call the game. Those duties will be left to Nick Kovac, the City of Milwaukee's budget director. You're just going to be wall-to-wall people involved in local government minutiae. Me and Nick having fun, and also joined by my old producer, Keith Godstad. Bunch of fun, food for all, fellowship with everybody, family-friendly, good fun to watch the Packers game. Come on out and see us at Linneman's. If you can't be there, don't be square. Check out the game on the Civic Media Radio Network. So much fun stuff coming up. We're going to be joined by Professor Catherine Eden this coming Tuesday. My friend Joanna Frotchek talking immigration. Lots of things on the docket for everybody. But today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about a Supreme Court case that they just announced this past Friday that they're going to take. And I thought it extraordinarily appropriate to talk about this case and the weather in one. Because the Supreme Court case that I'm referring to has to do with basically criminalizing people that are unhoused. So it could have huge, big, wide-reaching and long-lasting negative effects on unhoused folks. And at the center of the case is a pretty simple question. Should local governments be able to ticket people and arrest them when they're unhoused, even when there's no available shelter space? That's the question. What do you think? Should local governments be able to arrest people who are unhoused if there's no available shelter space? Yes or no? That is the question that the Supreme Court's going to be weighing in on. 844-967-2789. This case, if you're taking notes at home, is called Johnson versus Grants Pass. And it is the result of an attempt by the town of Grants Pass in Oregon to cite and arrest unhoused people who are basically using sort of tents or other very rudimentary shelters when the town ran out of available shelter space for unhoused folks. And it was taken up by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals after Grants Pass passed an ordinance in an attempt to get around a 2018 ruling also by the Ninth Circuit. That case was Martin v. Boise, that prohibited states from criminalizing unsheltered homelessness when there was not enough shelter space. At the root of this is whether or not those criminal penalties for being unhoused amount to a violation of the Eighth Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment. What's stranger still about this case is that there are a bunch of Democrats that want this power to be okay for local governments to exercise. Gavin Newsom, governor of California, joined the request to have the Supreme Court take up the case. That's a little surprising, right? Obviously, there is a crisis of housing that has gone across the country. It's gotten worse since conservatives refused to re-up the crucial middle class support measures that President Biden put in place under the American Rescue Plan Act. Our mental health infrastructure is terrible. That leads to an incredible amount of folks without housing. And it just, to me, this strikes me as quite problematic. And meanwhile, back here in Wisconsin, there is a GOP proposed bill that does three things. And you can see that the bill is sort of accounting for the Supreme Court precedent. So the GOP bill doesn't try to criminalize being unhoused in and of itself. But here's what the bill does. It withholds basically state pass-through grant money for homelessness programs unless they meet certain requirements. Meaning you have to be able to get people off the streets. You have to keep people at these agencies to help them with housing, and you have to help them find jobs. And if it's not achieving those metrics, the grant funding is withheld. A little odd, like, hey, you're trying to help people, but you're not helping them fast enough or good enough, so we'll stop giving you the money to help anybody at all. I'm not sure that logic tracks. The second thing it does is it includes a plan for structured camping facilities. Otherwise known as by us lay folks as tent cities. We've seen them in and around Milwaukee a lot. And if anyone stays outside of a municipality's structured camping area or tent city, they can be fined or spend a month in jail. So they do eventually reach these criminal penalties for people basically being unhoused. What do you think? Is this okay? 844-967-2789. Get on the line. We're going to get all of you in before we get to the bottom of the hour. 844-967-2789. And here's what. I wanted to link this together with the weather that we're all experiencing. And if Anya's got them, we're going to listen to some folks who you may recognize their voices talk about climate. Let them rip, Anya.
Which one do you want, Maggie? You've got so many for me.
Well, start with your favorite. Don't care what. Maybe start with a former president talking about climate change.
Let me find that one for you.
She loves it when I spring this stuff on her, like right at the top of the hour. We're not warming up. We're just getting right into it here on the Maggie Dawn Show. For some context, everybody, as we get up to this, since about 2014, where there was a huge deep freeze that sat basically across the entire United States as a result of the polar vortex, we hear repeatedly from folks that it's cold outside, so climate change can't be real. That's not how it works. So let us start with this basic distinction. Weather is what happens on a day-to-day basis. Climate is how weather trends over time. It requires a trend. In other words, an anecdote doesn't prove a big point. Another analogy to this would be you have a general personality, but your mood can change from day to day. That's the difference between weather and climate, something that folks that try to use especially cold days and cold snaps and the polar vortexes, I don't know what the plural of that is. I'm assuming it's vortexes. Try to use those to basically make the argument that climate change isn't real. It's totally spurious. Anya, you look like you're ready now. She is. Let's listen to some sound.
Nobody knows where they are. And you should say, look, if you mention that word one more time, we're going to send them over and we'll be coasting.
And by the
back and forth, up and down your coast. You can't let this tragedy continue. You okay. Can't let these thousands of people die. It's going to be hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people by the time it ends. Well,
he's talking about climate change and basically asserting that it's not real and that these people who try to promote the idea of climate change, they're the ones that are going to lead to these thousands of people dying. There was a big swear word in the middle of it. Anya, you got more sound?
Is the climate changing because of human activity?
In my opinion, you have a thing called weather, and you go up and you go down. If you look into the 1920s, they were talking about global freezing. Okay, in other words, the globe was going to freeze. And then they go global warming. Then they couldn't use that because the temperatures were actually quite cool. And many different things. So that, now they just talk about climate change. The climate's always been changing in the environment.
Is the climate is the climate changing because of human activity?
It goes on. If you've got the sound from Rachel Campos Duffy, I think this was just this past Sunday on Fox and Friends, that would be lovely to take a listen to.
Now the left is actually using new terms for global warming, like extreme weather. Why do they keep changing the language? Are they just pushing the same old agenda with new words?
And
that's next.
The doctor is in, Ed and Ainsley.
It's pretty rich. That wasn't Rachel Campos Duffy, but she was part of that discussion on Fox and Friends this past Sunday. The actual facts are this. This is CNN reporting. I believe this article dropped just yesterday. They're reporting about a study that was published by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which has identified a stark change in the tactics of climate change deniers over the past few years. This is CNN. Where once climate change deniers would outright reject climate change as a hoax or scam, or claim that humans were not in fact responsible for it, many are now shifting to a different approach, one which attempts to undermine climate science, cast doubt on climate solutions, and even claim that global warming will be beneficial at best, harmless at worst. Here we go with the projection where they're saying, oh, well, people talking about climate change are using different language. No. That's what you all are doing. And lest we forget our friend Ron Johnson, who basically deployed this precise tactic in trying to defend a position where we don't do anything about climate when he was questioning a witness earlier this summer testifying before one of his Senate committees. Give us a call. In this moment where, you know, at least by the last count in the last Journal Sentinel reporting that I saw, four people have died thus far in and around the Milwaukee area due to the cold from hypothermia. We've got this legislation coming through basically criminalizing being unhoused. How does this stack up for all of you? If you are on the line, stay there. If you're not there yet, give us a call. Tell me what you think. Should being unhoused be a crime? 844-967-2789. Back with more in just a moment. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're talking about housing policy and helping out people who are unhoused, especially given this moment of extreme and extraordinary cold. And the fact that the Supreme Court's basically going to review whether criminalizing being unhoused is a violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. That's a case that's coming out of the Ninth Circuit, including Oregon, Washington State, California. They're going to hear that case this term. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin is endeavoring to do basically the thing that's currently being legally challenged and that the Ninth Circuit already found once was, in fact, an Eighth Amendment violation. The bill that's being proposed, again, basically makes housing programs subject to certain qualifications before they get funding. It regulates tent cities as we know them. And if someone is not abiding by the regulated tent city in the right place, it basically says that's a crime and we're going to fine you and put you in jail, which to me doesn't seem to be a good housing policy since jailing people is really expensive. But I want to hear from you. 844-967-2789. Chris from Sun Prairie, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Hi. Yeah, we absolutely should not be fining people and putting them in jail for being homeless. I mean, if we want to address people being homeless, let's do it in a positive way. Let's get them housing. I just don't understand this idea that we are going to criminalize homelessness. I mean, they have people that have problems, and we're going to give them more. It's just it's terrible. The people that are putting these laws forward need to be removed from office. And I don't care what they have behind their name. We need to start looking for people that care about the communities. We need real public service people in office. We need people that care about what's happening in our communities, not about what's best for some board of directors somewhere.
Let me ask you a question, Chris, if I can, if you can stay on the line for just a little bit longer.
Sure.
Here's my question. The counter argument, if you think about places like San Francisco and even in the city of Milwaukee, there have been a proliferation of tent cities that have popped up, and people that live closer or adjacent to these tent cities get concerned about drug use and crime and those kinds of things. And they're saying, listen, something has to be done. It's not safe to have people congregating in these tent cities. What are we to do? What's the right approach? If you were living right next to a tent city, right? Or it was a block away, say. And we agree that we should be getting people into reliable, stable housing. But in that moment, if it was right next to your home, what's the next step? What should be the expectation of government? How do we solve that problem?
Well, I guess we have to bring in some temporary form of housing, and our government can do that if they need it to. We've seen it before. I mean, we have floods in places, and we bring in temporary housing. And I think that if that's what we need to do, that's what we need to do. We cannot have people dying on the streets. This is crazy. And we really need to stop these policies that have driven people into the streets. People lose their jobs. People lose their homes. There's a lot of people that this trickle-down economics just chips away at them and chips away at them and chips away at them, and nobody pays attention. They don't know the stories of the people in the streets. And they really should understand how the people are getting there, because they're not just winding up there for any old reason. It's because the policies of this government for the last 40 years.
Amen, Chris. I couldn't have said it any better. I am consistently and always impressed and humbled by the callers that we get here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Thank you for sharing such heartfelt and well thought out opinions, Chris. Thank you. I couldn't agree more. I don't think the problem for someone who is struggling with mental health, addiction, and can't maintain stable housing is to criminalize those issues. It's just not. We have loitering ordinances, right? We have a whole manner of things. If people are actually creating or breaking those laws, there are penalties there. But finding people for basically being in a state of being unhoused seems to not be the right approach. I mean, if we all agree that stable housing for everybody is our goal and that's a good thing, shouldn't we be asking ourselves, what are the policies that actually lead to a greater amount of stable housing for the greatest amount of people in a tax-efficient dollar way? I don't think putting people in jail is that solution. I think that's extremely expensive. It's extremely expensive. It's inhumane. And we have a mental health and addiction crisis in this country, and we don't have the infrastructure to deal with that. Also, next week, I will be addressing what I'm going to call pernicious, long-time unemployment for people, especially over the age of 50, and how our brains in the United States work about that, how hard it is for people after that age, if they become unemployed, they're laid off, to actually find gainful employment. I will just say this, and then we're going to take another call. I would guarantee you that within your circle of acquaintances and friends, including coworkers and people that you know from your houses of worship, from your gym, that someone in your immediate circle of people that you interact with frequently, someone has faced housing insecurity or has themselves been unhoused. And I ask you to consider, what if you, by no fault of your own, lost your job and couldn't find gainful employment for a while? Does that make you a criminal? Mark from Prairie Sack, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you, my friend?
Yeah, well, it certainly shouldn't. I mean, it's an issue that has been a pernicious problem in the United States for humanity for a long time. It's something that should be addressed, you know, that to actually find, you know, secure housing for these people and the care that they need. But, you know, let's face it. I mean, that for climate change, I mean, it's something that we ignored back in the, you know, the chemical oil companies knew about, you know, climate change was going to happen back in the 70s. I mean, the problems we face with invasive species, for example, in the Great Lakes, that is something I can remember discussing that back in ecology class back in 1975, when we figured the ocean boats coming in should be flushing their ballast tanks, you know, to prevent that kind of thing. But we ignore an issue for decades and decades, and then when it gets worse and worse and worse, they say, well, you know, they want to fall back on draconian measures to take care of it, and it's something that requires us to do something entirely different.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I agree with you. Angie from Monroe also texting in, the price of housing is crazy. I'm in an old farmhouse falling down, and I'm old school. And yes, the price of housing, especially in the post-COVID environment, has just exploded. We have to do better by people, and criminalizing economic misfortune is not, in my view, the way to a more fair, more just society. And it's certainly not the way to do well by our neighbors, by our friends, because I guarantee you someone you know has struggled with housing. My name is Maggie Dawn. We're going to be joined by none other than Jimmy Kosko when we come back talking education here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Keep it locked, everybody. We got a hell of a half hour lined up for you next. Join our conversation, 844-967-2789. Feed me, sunlight, feed me air. Busy images can wait. Feed me. It's lonely. Standing there, killing time. Can't commit to anything but a crime. Leaders on vacation. An open invitation. Animals. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Give me and Anya a call. Say hello to her. Wish her well. 844-967-2789. Super excited to be joined by a guest for this next segment. Jimmy Kosko, an education expert at the state's education convention. But before we get to my good friend, Jimmy, I just wanted to take one of our longtime regular callers, Tom from LA, wanted to share a little bit and weigh in on the question about should we be criminalizing people who are unhoused? Welcome, Tom from LA.
Hey, Maggie. First off, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that. And we must remember that we're all in this together. And you know, when we all do better when we all do better. And there's a lot of houses out there that are completely vacant, and they're completely, you know, bad landscaping and things like that, that you could actually, you know, make a deal with some people and say, hey, look, you know, we'll give you some housing, but we want you to, you know, keep up with the housing. We want you to make sure the lawn's mowed. We want to make sure, you know, the snow is shoveled, whatever it might be. But that's what you know, will have in terms of if they are capable, of course, in terms of mentally capable of being able to do so. You know, there's some, and then that will also help the owner of that property because their property value will go up.
Yeah, I hear you, Tom. I think it's so critical to emphasize Tom's point. High tides raise all ships. When we do well by our neighbors and friends, and even those we don't know, it generally helps us do better. If we can do better by housing for folks, it will make our overall community much more stronger, much more safe, much more well, and that builds community. Speaking of how we pay for things that help us all out, Jimmy Kosko, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. How is the State Educational Convention kicking off?
Boy, we're 2 days into the 3-day event, and today is what they this is the day where you got to pace yourself, because there's a lot that happens from 7 a.m. And there's still actually some events going on through 7 o'clock tonight. So this is the day where you really got to pace yourself a bit. There's a lot of information to absorb at these things. And this is my second year at it. So I know how to pace myself at it, but for sure, there's a lot going on here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. What would you say, Jimmy, is sort of the focus of the convention this year, either in what people are talking about, which sometimes even when they brand conventions, everybody's actually talking about something else, either what's on people's minds or what is the very explicit focus of the convention this year?
So the convention is branding itself as New Horizons for Education. There were a number of breakout sessions talking about things like AI, talking about things like, you know, technical security, you know, infrastructure. But I got to tell you, the overwhelming theme of the speeches that we've had here today and yesterday and a lot of the breakout sessions has dealt with school funding, in particular talking about referenda, because it is pretty anecdotally, that we're probably going to break that referendum record this year for operational referenda that go on ballots. 92 is the record set 2 years ago. There was a survey done by the WASBO, Wisconsin Association of School Business Officials. Of their responses, 38% of schools, or 136 that responded, said they're considering a referenda this year for operational expenses. So that is number one on people's minds, I believe, this year, in light of the biennial budget and some of the changes to the school funding there. A couple of things that didn't go far enough for public school advocates, but still a slight increase in certain areas there. And then obviously the end of federal COVID money is what is going to really kick the referenda into high gear, if not already here in April, where we could see over 100 on the ballots. Throughout the course of the year, we're going to see quite a few referenda.
So for those of you who may not be as acquainted as Jimmy is with this question of referenda, in most jurisdictions within the state of Wisconsin, both capital and operational spending increases can effectively be mandated by the voters by putting a referenda that poses the question about, do you want to spend X amount of dollars to do A, B, and C for your school district that you're in? One of the facts that, and I'm probably going to get the exact statistic wrong, Jimmy, that I found fascinating, that when I was prepping for one of my earlier discussions, I think end of November, with Professor Catherine Eden, who's a professor at Princeton that studies poverty and has studied vouchers and universal vouchers. One of the things that I find really interesting as a statistic, in the state of Wisconsin, there had been a long history of the majority of those referenda getting approved by, like, not just the margin of votes, but like of whatever total number of school funding referenda in a year, upwards of 80% would get adopted by voters. That there was basically universal nonpartisan agreement that we need to fund well public schooling. And when the public school experts and officials and school boards come to us, the taxpayers and voters, and ask for more money, we generally gave it to them. That statistic of the overall passage rate of referendum requests has gone down precipitously in recent years. And there's a much higher level of suspicion. Is that getting talked about? Is there an existential feeling in the air that, gee whiz, we are going to be, you know, between a rock and a hard place from a funding standpoint?
I got a number of points I could react to here. I'll just say, as far as the feeling, the fiscal cliff caused by the end of ESSER dollars, the federal COVID pandemic funding, has most certainly triggered a number of schools to consider referenda. In fact, the statistic that I saw from WASBO yesterday was 62% of districts said that they would be in an operational or structural deficit because of the end of ESSER. I can speak from the school board I'm on in Boscobel, which is in southwestern Wisconsin. We balanced our budget with the rest of our ESSER dollars this year, and we weren't alone. A lot of rural schools did this. So,
and these were for operational expenditures, not capital expenditures. If you're not an accounting geek, capital is when you build stuff. Operational is paying salaries, buying books, making sure the heat and the lights stay on, right, Jimmy?
Yeah, the things that make schools work. And that's really why you're going to see in the state of Wisconsin, it's going to affect just about everybody, because most schools already have tried a referendum. A lot of them have passed it. The statistics shared today at one of the sessions I was in was that in the state for referenda, like the recurring, the operational referenda, 10% of school districts have 10% or more of their funding coming from operational referenda. I don't know how that's sustainable. They're expecting that number to jump to 14% after this year. And what that is you're asking the taxpayers over either a fixed amount of time in a non-recurring or the recurring, which permanently increases your levy, asking them for more money to help keep the lights on, essentially. Last spring, there were two districts who said that if we don't pass the operational referendum, we have to begin the steps to consolidate with neighboring districts. And that affects taxpayers more because now you got to pay for transportation. You got to pay, for the school probably has to add on to accommodate the new students. Consolidation usually doesn't work out in favor of the taxpayers and the district closing. So there's a lot of that going on
here. Yeah. How did we get here, Jimmy? Because yes, everybody that has anything to do with or has any sight line on local government understands how these pandemic relief funds rolling off have had some serious operational impacts. But this didn't happen just because of COVID, did it?
No, this started before COVID. So what our legislature did was they decoupled the state aid from inflation. And what that did is it started creating this gap. So instead of the per pupil funding going along with inflation, it decoupled from it. And then in very short order, the gap widened and widened to the point where the statistic thrown out by some of the business officials that were presenting in the last 2 days said that right now schools could are essentially missing out because of that gap over $3,000 per student. That's the gap since they decoupled it from inflation.
And I want to be real clear, because decoupling from inflation, somebody could be like, yawn, I don't know what that means. So school funding is largely based on state aids, meaning the state decides how much each school district gets. There's very complicated formulas beyond the scope of what we can cover in our little discussion here. But those state aid formulas increased every year for a very long time, based on what the inflation was, right? Because inflation affects the cost of providing all of those operational expenses, right?
Correct. And that happened before Act 10. That was just before that. In fact, the graduating class of 2023 was the first class to go 4K through graduation with that being pulled from inflation. So then it was up to the legislature to either provide a per student increase, like what happened in this biennial budget with $325. But because of that, they hadn't done that for the two previous years, assuming that the pandemic aid would kind of cover that gap, that cumulative effect is actually leaving districts an even greater shortfall because inflation was such a big deal. Last year, that inflation index was at 8%. And some school districts tried to match that with salaries and increases, but a lot of small districts, including ours,
can't.
We couldn't get that full 8%. There's no way. I mean, there's no way we could come close to it.
So I really want to highlight two things I want everybody, because this matters more in rural districts than it does in large urban districts. Two things here, maybe three. First, this decoupling happened under Scott Walker. Second, when you look at that gap, what it effectively means is that you have to have a legislature each year decide to adequately fund the operational expenses of schools. And if they can't do that, or they don't want to for whatever set of reasons, you're creating a built-in operational expense shortfall every year. And it gets worse every year, because then you're playing catch up. Am I getting this mostly right, Jimmy?
And you know, the thing is when you go to an operational referendum, you are permanently creating that hole in your budget. Like, that does not go away. So now you, as a taxpayer, you're dealing with that even beyond the year that it's asked in the ballot. And to be quite honest, I said it right to the co-finance chair, Howard Markline, at a listening session this week in Grant County. I said, I'm not the man with numbers. Like, my wife is in mortgaging. That's her thing. I'm here to talk and have some, and all that. But I said, this is not a sustainable model for funding schools. And what's happening too is it appears that there's some attempt to kind of fund two different education systems now with the voucher program. And that's, I think that part of it is really complicating things when it comes to school funding, because now the advocation for school choice versus public schools, well, the reality is that rural schools are the rural school districts as a number are over half of the districts in the state with only about 20 to 25% of the students. But, you know, on the other side of that, public school students in Wisconsin, that's 83% of all students in the state. So if we're shorting 4 out of 5 kids in the state, I just don't see how that's fair. And I don't understand the motivation to kind of leave that large group of students behind, especially when it comes to special needs students. So,
right. It doesn't work any way you slice this, right? Because two things are coming together. One, if you're a rural district and you don't have enough for your operational increases year over year, it gets worse every year. And you can't make that up from the largesse of your budget. Right. Mm-hmm. Like in large districts, it is possible to try to move some dollars around, cost cut in other places to help retain teachers, be sure that kids have updated textbooks. But when you're in small districts, it can't happen. So the way that the legislature is approaching this is broken to begin with. Then when you couple it with the idea that we're going to funnel more taxpayer dollars into what is effectively religious-based private education systems that taxpayers are paying for, pulling more dollars away from public schools, that's hurting rural districts and the urban districts and special needs students.
I believe it creates equity issues too, because now rural districts can't afford to match what urban and suburban districts can offer in terms of salary, in terms of the services in an area. You have equity issues there. And then obviously the big one is with special education. 33%-ish reimbursement rate for public schools, 90% for private schools. That's a really big gap. And I know that this week the DPI, and they said it again here at the convention, they're looking to increase that to 60%.
Yeah, we've got so many issues. Jimmy, would you be willing to come back next week? I'd love to talk with you more about this. We didn't simply have enough time. This is so important. It matters to everybody. My thanks to you. That's Jimmy Cuska of the Civic Media Radio Network reporting to you about what is going on at the Wisconsin Educators Conference happening this week in Milwaukee. When we come back, Terry Barr is going to tell us what is local and overlooked in Wisconsin this week. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Once the water starts to rise, and heaven's out of sight. Don't stay in touch. Everybody's tripping over this or that. What we gonna do when we all fall flat? Liar, the world's on fire.
Ain't that the question? What are we gonna do when we all fall flat? That's Dolly Parton's World on Fire. National treasure that is Dolly Parton lives by the thing, by the creed that I hope we're bringing to this show, which is, when we stand together, it is always better. I am so happy to welcome for our last segment of the day, my friend and yours, Terry Barr, to tell us what is local and overlooked. Welcome, Terry. You staying warm out there? Burr, it's chilly.
The sun helps during the daytime, but yeah, the darkness comes in and you just feel like you are chilled right to the bone. Oh my goodness. Great Dolly song there. Wow.
Anya always picks the best stuff. And nobody can ever listen to enough Dolly Parton, right? I mean, she's just fabulous.
I agree. Well, I have some local and overlooked stories for you. Let's start with some jobs. Now, many of us have probably heard about the Energizer Battery Company. It's leaving the Portage area. It's been there more than 130 years. Okay, more than 200 people are going to be losing their jobs when the Central Wisconsin manufacturer closes. But what you probably haven't heard about, there is a startup, and it's buying land for a new plant to create, get this, hemp-based batteries. This is considered a brand new option to any of the lithium batteries, and those working on these batteries say they offer a longer life and a lower cost. This is also going to bring, they're losing 200 jobs with the Energizer plant. This one is going to bring 600 jobs to the Portage area. So that's some good news to hear about.
Go Portage. Here's what I would love to see. And that is And that is, if we take the folks that are working in the Energizer plant, we talk to the folks that are bringing in the hemp-based lithium batteries, and we say, hey, what skills do people need to get these jobs in the hemp-based lithium battery plant? And hey, do we have a skills mismatch? And let's throw it open and make sure we're getting people the skills training. Have local government or state government jump in, DWD, help be sure that people are ready and able to fill those jobs that new hemp lithium battery plant is going to need. Those are the kind of places that I think government really has an opportunity.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much, because you hate to hear about anybody losing their jobs, especially when things seem like, I don't know, it's kind of tough out there. I have one more story for you if you want to hear it.
Heck yeah, Terry, you got plenty of time.
All right. Well, we were talking about the cold weather. I don't know. Maybe we can blame the cold weather or a loss of jobs, since we were also just talking about that. But some crooks may be trying to warm up or something by breaking into liquor stores. This is happening all across the state right now. Two in the Cottage Grove area, another one in downtown Madison, one in Eau Claire, three in Wausau. Police say similar thing. You know, they all have glass doors. Those were shattered. And in all of the cases, expensive liquor was stolen. So that was the target. So far, only one arrest, and that's in one of the Wausau cases. Officers there say they caught this suspect when they pulled him over for, get this, Maggie, drunk driving. Yeah.
Listen, if you do rob a liquor store, I suggest waiting until you get home before you consume the stuff that you stole from the liquor store.
I just thought this was such a curious case, interesting timing all over the state. And then what happened, at least how they caught the one person, I thought, oh, we'll have some fun with this.
Yeah. Do they think these things were related, or is this just sort of, it happens when it's cold out and people need good alcohol? There's a spate of liquor store break-ins.
Yeah, they don't think Eau Claire is related, if it's a copycat kind of thing. The ones in Cottage Grove and Madison, they are being looked at as being similar. The timing is pretty close together in the last couple of days. Wausau, that one was spread out over the last couple of weeks. And they still, you know, in that Wausau case, they believe they still only caught one of the suspects.
Well, my only story that I can share about illicit alcohol-related stuff isn't really appropriate networking. Actually, there is one story I can tell. When I lived in New York, this actually made the papers. And that was people were nothing to do with me, Terry. Importing to New York State spotted cow from New Glarus, and it hadn't yet been improved. It hadn't been appropriately licensed. I don't understand. Like, the myriad regulations are quite complicated for interstate liquor and alcohol distribution. But there were a couple of bars that were selling it basically illegally. It was a huge big bust, and I was like, no kidding. They love the cow in New York City too, to the extent that they're shipping that stuff in illegally. Listen, anywhere that Wisconsin, right, meat, cheese, and beer, people are willing to break the law to get it to themselves. It tells you how good our meat, cheese, and beer is, right?
Exactly. We are so Wisconsin. Oh my goodness.
Always good to talk to you, Terry. Thanks so much for what is local and overlooked here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to you next week. Listen, folks, it's been quite a ride this very cold week. What I hope we've come away with sort of as an overall theme is that many of these issues can be spun and talked about as if they're simple. They're not. And when somebody tells you something is simple, it is very often a big old riddle. And what we're going to endeavor to do here more and more in this year is help us all understand these riddles in a way that speaks to all of our values, no matter what your politics may be. Because I truly believe we have more in common that separates us And if somebody is trying to divide, I say they lie. I'm Maggie Dawn. You have been listening to a very cold week of the Maggie Dawn Show. Go to the Civic Media website. Check out the show notes. Fill out the survey and tell me what I should be talking about every day with you all good people. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other, because it's always better when we do it together. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Stay warm out there and go Pack!